Hi everyone, welcome to the Philosophy Exchange podcast. I'm Jakob, and today I'm joined by Rob, Lorenzo, and for the very first time on the Philosophy Exchange podcast, Gabriel. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Hello.
Today we're going to talk about inferences in philosophy, or more specifically about inference to the best explanation. Let's start off with a short story that I was being told earlier. So Sherlock Holmes and Watson go on a camping trip. And during the night, they're lying on the ground, looking up in the sky. And Watson starts meandering and thinking about the meaning of the world and says, Sherlock, look at those stars. Look at this infinite width of the universe. Doesn't it make you wonder about everything? And Sherlock Holmes answers, no, it means someone stole our tent. Okay.
So it's a good way to start, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wait, I actually know another induction joke.
Okay, go ahead.
So it's like a person who's revising for a philosophy of science exam, and they read through all of the past papers and they see that the problem of induction has come up on 9 out of 10 of the last papers. So they decide that they won't revise for it for the next one because it's probably not going to come up.
Was it a joke, Rob?
Okay, that's a joke.
It's more like a thinking joke.
I think we can leave it.
I can't remember why they got it the right way around. Is it that he thinks that he doesn't have to revise it, or he definitely will revise it?
You know, Rob, in this moment, you are the emblematic example of a philosophical meme. So it's like, what is the meaning of the joke? What was the way around it? So, Gabriel, why don't you tell us something about inference to the best explanation? What is the difference with other kinds of inference that we normally encounter in philosophy and in science?
All right. So usually inference to the best explanation, or as it sometimes is called, abduction, it's kind of contrasted against two other very familiar forms of inference called deduction and induction. And I'll just give a sort of quick glance about what these are. Deduction is, you know, what you see in logic and mathematics when you try to like prove something from premises. And deduction has this really interesting property whereby if your premises are all true and your deductions are valid, then your conclusions strictly follow from the premises. There's no sort of room for error or anything like that.
Do you have an example of that?
Yeah. For instance, any logical proof, for instance, like the old go-to, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. As long as the premises there are true, which they seemingly are, then the conclusion, Socrates is mortal, follows from that, and it always does.
So you mean we can say something like, for the conclusion, it's impossible to be false, given that the two, or the premises in general, are true?
Precisely.
Okay. And instead, what is induction? How does it work?
Induction, then, is a subspecies of what we would call ampliative inference, which differs from deduction in that it kind of goes beyond the evidence which you have, and a conclusion in like what we might call inductive logic or statistics, maybe, would be a good example of this, hold on, Kat, I think that statistic thing just kind of complicates things. So can I start over?
So in a certain sense, in the deductive reasoning, the truth of the conclusion, it's in a certain sense already contained in the truth of the premises of the argument. Instead, when you're doing an induction, you are like observing something in reality. I don't know, the classic example is like, I see a black raven, and then I see a second one, a third one. And after a number of them, I can say, well, the next one that I will see will be black.
Exactly. But there is like a sense in there which it doesn't necessarily follow from you having observed a lot of black ravens in the past that the next one you will observe will be black as well. It just doesn't follow. It's maybe extraordinarily likely, given that and sort of maybe, you know, background knowledge that we have. But there is nothing like that prevents you from observing a or it doesn't seem strange to observe a white raven, like at least in the space of possibilities, right?
That would be the other famous example of induction, if I remember correctly, of the swans, which were always assumed to be white. So like in Europe, everyone was like, oh, all the swans we've seen so far, therefore swans must be white. And then I think James Cook or one of the other adventurers in Australia suddenly encountered a black swan, which then kind of disproved or like interrupted the inference from like a lot of swans to all swans.
And that is actually something like really similar to what Popper was saying. So when we are doing science, we normally try to falsify hypotheses, because to verify an hypothesis, you have this inductive leap that can lead you to some kind of false result. Instead, when you generalize the sentence like all the swans are white, then you can find a counterexample to make it false. And so you can add something to the scientific endeavor.
And there's also a sense in which making the wrong inference can actually be really practically dangerous. So Nicholas Taleb uses the metaphor of a black swan to discuss high-risk events, catastrophic things that could affect humanity that we perhaps miss because they haven't happened in the past, so we're not looking out for them.
Like pandemics, although they've happened before. So we should have known.
And instead, Gabriel, what is the difference between abduction and induction? So many people, I read something on this, consider abduction a kind of inductive inference. So what can we say about abduction and the difference with induction?
Well, abduction is often sort of framed as being almost like a tack-on to break these kinds of what we sort of can call underdetermination cases. So for instance, if we're trying to make an inference, we've seen a lot of white swans, and then sort of, but the leap from that, the next one I'll see will be black versus the next one I'll see will be white, isn't determined by the evidence. There's like this uncertainty there. So what inference to the best explanation does is look at tied, so evidentially equivalent hypotheses, and then go, okay, but one of these sort of hypotheses explains more than the other and is in some sense like we makes us understand the world better or something like that. So out of the two, we should pick the one explanation that gives the best explanation of the phenomenon in question.
It makes sense. So I always thought of a little example to make it clear to myself what abduction or inference to the best explanation is. Like you find a piece of cheese all bitten. You wake up in the morning and you find it on the table that it's already like bitten. And then during the night, you hear some kind of noises in the ceiling. And at a certain point, you can even find some kind of excrements around in the room. And so the best explanation that we can find for this is like there is a rat in the house. Of course, it's not the only possible explanation. It could be the case that some people are trying to make a joke to me or something like that, or I don't know, whatever explanation you can find out. So like an alien came and it's like behaving like a rat, but it's not. Mm. But normally in the everyday life, we always use this kind of best explanation inference to explain stuff that occurs around us.
Do you often leave bits of cheese lying out around your house, Lorenzo?
No, actually no. But I think I found this example on a book and I found it always like really like clear what we mean when we are talking about inference to the best explanation. So it's not just an induction. It's an induction in a certain sense, but it's we have the intuition that our guess is a little bit more structured, more solid, more robust, because we can give a lot of reasons to support our conclusion. Of course, it's not definitive. It's not like the last answer to the question. We could come up with another explanation with new evidence. But yeah, until proven otherwise, the rat hypothesis is the best one.
I think if you did leave cheese around the house, you might have found a new flatmate.
Okay, so are there some kind of applications, interesting applications of the inference to the best explanation in philosophy, Rob?
Yeah, I've got one, Lorenzo. So there's a famous argument that the philosopher J.L. Mackey made that objective moral values don't exist. And by objective moral values, I mean sort of universal truths about what is right and what is wrong. And so he used an inference to best explanation to make this case. And Mackey said that if objective moral values did exist, they would be incredibly weird and different to other kinds of objective facts or other kinds of things that we can find out, for example, through the scientific method. And so this was because they would have an inbuilt property of to be doneness, as Mackey called it, which would just be really strange because sort of other kinds of facts, like mathematical facts, sort of seem like they objectively exist, but they don't tell us anything. Like we don't have to do something as a result of them. And so Mackey's conclusion from this was that actually a better explanation was just that objective moral values don't exist at all. And so this was a way in which inference to the best explanation was used to quite a devastating effect. And it's a very well-known and popular argument in meta-ethics.
Are you convinced by this argument?
I think it is very powerful. I suppose that you can have some kind of partners in crime objection. So basically to try and identify like other things that have the same property, but we commonly think they exist. So there are other kinds of like sort of objective values that we think might exist, like aesthetic values. And as well, there do seem to be some like weird things about other facts that we hold to be objective, like mathematical facts, even if they don't tell us to do something. It does seem, there's just there seems quite something strange there, but it's not commonly thought that they don't exist. So I think that's probably the best line of attack to Mackey's argument.
It's interesting that you said that as an example of objective facts, you mentioned mathematics. That is really interesting for me as a philosopher of science of thinking mathematics as something objective. Instead, it's like more or less like mathematical representations are normally, I think of them as the best explanation that we can give to phenomena. So some kind of application to reality and to observation. And I think it's connected with something that I wanted to ask Gabriel about the application of inference to the best explanation in philosophy of science.
Oh, yeah. There's this pretty sort of famous argument for scientific realism called the no miracles argument. And it begins, yeah?
Can you say something about what is scientific realism?
Yeah, scientific realism is basically the view that our best scientific theories basically get it right at describing the world. So for instance, our most fundamental physics like quantum mechanics and general relativity and so on, the way they describe the world is in some way like what the world is like. If, say, it posits that fields are what sort of govern behavior of this and this and that, then yeah, that's the way that that it is. And usually we think of there's like this leap between these theories being very successful in predicting phenomena, giving rise to experiments that can be replicated across many different laboratories and lead to sort of technologies that can be repeatedly exploited for various purposes. And you might still agree to that, but not think that the theory in question is necessarily strictly like a true representation of what the world is like. So what someone who is inclined towards scientific realism might say then is that, well, look, look at how successful our scientific theories are. It would basically be a miracle if they turned out to be false, but still have this kind of predictive power and ability to kind of synthesize large amounts of knowledge and sort of lead to these repeatable interventions in nature and whatnot. So the best explanation of the success of these theories is just that they are like literally true and that they actually represent the world as it is, more or less. Like, we can still have some, it doesn't need to be literally true. There might be some that it gets wrong details, basically. But as long as it basically gets the job done, then yeah.
Right. Thanks. I think most of us in our group, and I think many others, aren't necessarily convinced by the no miracle argument, even though I think the way you put it was a quite convincing way. One of the counter arguments against the no miracles arguments is the so-called pessimistic meta-induction. And this basically attacks one of the premises of the no miracles arguments, which is that science is actually a success. And the pessimistic meta-induction says, like, look, we've had so many scientific theories over all of history, and all of these scientific theories at some point turned out to be false. They were overturned by better theories. What's it to stop us to think that our theories that we have now, as good as they may be in predicting phenomena, why shouldn't they be overturned completely at some point in the future?
Yeah, here in philosophy of science, you can see this kind of clash of titans between realists and anti-realists using the no miracle argument and pessimistic meta-induction, respectively. And it's really difficult because both of them are not definitive arguments for reality of scientific entities or scientific structures. And so, I don't know, probably depends on what is your take on history of science, for example, how science developed in the centuries.
And I think the pessimistic meta-induction is not attacking the inference in itself, but rather the premise before the inference. So it's like not even an attack against the IBE itself, saying, okay, there might be another explanation. This may not be the best way to go about doing things in philosophy, but rather saying, okay, so the thing we're trying to explain is actually not there. So like the success of science is actually not there. And so we don't need to explain it at all.
Yeah, or like you can also think of this as kind of severing the conceptual connection between, or the inferential connection, I should say, between success and truth. Newton's theory of like mechanics and whatnot was pretty damn successful and managed to sort of spawn a whole different sort of post-Newtonian physics was, like, by all accounts, a really interesting description of the world it managed to predict and sort of bring experimental control to a lot of phenomena. It nevertheless turned out to be literally false, although a like pretty good model of the world in certain respects.
That's particularly true. And I had another counter-argument. It's particularly against the no-miracle argument. In a certain sense, philosophers say, well, you're using the inference to the best explanation in a wrong way, because in philosophy, you cannot use inference to the best explanation to prove the truth of science. Why? Because science overall is a kind of really complex inference to the best explanation. And if you're applying the inference to the best explanation to demonstrate the truth of science, there is some kind of circularity there. So you're using the inference to the best explanation to prove that the inference to the best explanation itself is valuable and reliable. So this is one of the most famous attack against the no-miracle argument.
I think what I'd be interested in after seeing these examples of IBE, I'd be quite interested in going from like the inference part of the inference to the best explanation to the explanation part. And what would count as an explanation so that some hypothesis could actually be considered to be the solution to an IBE?
It's a pretty good question. Like, there are a lot of theories of explanation out there. There are sort of a couple or three that I think we should go over. And the most famous and sort of where this all started comes from a guy called Hempel, who proposed what as a method of explanation called the deductive nomological theory of explanation. Hempel was basically sort of really, when we think of it like explanations, usually we think of something that clarifies something or provides understanding of it. But Hempel was kind of skeptical about understanding and sort of using that to ground explanation because he thought it was kind of pragmatic and subjective. science is supposed to be something that's relatively, you know, free from so such subjective considerations about like understanding quantum mechanics, for instance, is like pretty difficult to understand, we'd think, but it still provides a pretty good model of what a world is like and it's empirically adequate and so on. But in any case, what he thought is like, well, an explanation is basically taking a phenomenon that you want to explain and subsuming it under a sort of higher order thing. What you're basically doing is to showing that the thing that you're supposed to explain is a special case of a sort of higher order theory. So for instance, explaining the sort of laws and regularities of chemistry would be explained by sort of showing how it follows deductively from the laws of physics. And that's where it kind of comes from, deductive, from the deducing something from a higher order law, and nomological, which is like pertaining to laws. But the DN explanation part is like, it's pretty limited in what it can do. And it has some pretty counterexamples. For instance, there are so many of them, and I don't think we have time to get into them here. But it has some pretty interesting issues. And yeah, what is it?
So I was thinking a really easy example is the flagpole.
Oh, yeah. So go ahead.
If you take a flagpole and you want to explain the length of the shadow created by the flagpole, you just look at the position of the sun and the laws of optics. Then you put inside of the argument the length of the flagpole, and from that you can deduce the shadow. And this is like a perfect explanation. The problem is that you can do also the other way around. So you can explain the position of the sun on the basis of the length of the shadow and the length of the flagpole and the laws of optics. And this seems a little bit counterintuitive. So we would not say that the position of the sun is explained by the length of the shadow. It may be like the shadow, it could be a sign or a good hint to predict where the sun is, but it doesn't mean that it's explaining it. Maybe because we have some kind of strong intuition that explanation is connected with causation, maybe? What do you think, Gabriel?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's something that more, a lot more philosophers who get into explanation after the deductive logical theory was kind of like, was shown to have these problems, is that people kind of start baking in causality and above all sort of the ability to generate understanding into theories of explanation. This is also supposedly motivated by, you know, historical cases of looking at what we call paradigmatically successful science, that the explanations that were sort of actually adopted by practicing scientists that we consider to be like fairly good scientific and practice seem to have this understanding part baked into it.
Okay, so I was going to ask another question. So when you do an inference to the best explanation, does it matter when you choose an explanation, does it make a difference when there are different types of explanations available? Does it make sense, the question?
Different types, let's see. What would you mean by sort of different types in this case?
So you just told us about like the DN model of explanation, yeah, the causal model of explanation. And now we're trying to explain something, some factor X out in the world. We're trying to explain this. We've got a couple of explanations. When we do this type of explanation, do they usually tend up to be the same type of explanation? So like if we have the cheese in the hole kind of thing, the hole in the cheese kind of thing, the other way around, we usually try to have different types of causal explanations, right? So there's a rat in the house, there's a weird roommate carving small holes into the cheese with a knife. I was just thinking while you were talking whether it would be possible to have like different types of explanations. So like a DN explanation, a causal explanation, a unificationist explanation out there for the same, trying to explain the same thing. I'm not sure this is actually a thing, but I was just wondering about this.
Another example that came to my mind is some kind of mathematical explanation. So sometimes you try to use mathematics to explain something. In a sense, you want to represent it in a really nice way and you connect it with other phenomena, but you're not telling us anything about the causal history that produced the fact that we want to explain. So maybe it's something connected with what Jakob wanted to say.
No, but I think there's something to it here. I mean, it's an interesting question because I was like thinking about the rat case. Maybe you have like this, you have a weird roommate and it's like well established that this guy just goes around and he does the most random stuff possible. And so you have like this theory of your roommate being a weirdo, right? So if you look at the cheese part, you could maybe sort of infer that, oh yeah, this is just one of his other antics. I have no idea how he did this. Or like what the sort of or the causal history behind it. He might have like done a Tom Cruise thing from the air vent, sort of came down and like plopped these things out. That would not be so unlike what something he would do. But if you think about it from like how a plausible causal story, on the other hand, then you may favor the rat explanation because you find rat droppings on the floor and the bite marks looks like something that has cheese on it. Now it might be sort of not necessarily something that you could easily kind of square off with other parts of your life. For instance, rats might not be very common where you live or something like that. So there might be some background factors like going against that. But here you have a tension between a unificationist maybe and a causal explanation. I don't know. I have no idea how a deductive nomological explanation would look in this case.
Yeah. Rob, you have something to say that's more important than I.
Well, I just have another question about the role of values in inference to the best explanation. How do we actually know what a best explanation is? Maybe we could know what a better explanation is, something sort of seems to fit the facts more, but is it possible that we would ever know what the best explanation is? Maybe there's something that we don't know that's out of our grasp.
I suppose in terms of like saying inference to the best explanation, we never know whether it's the best explanation, because supposedly if we knew it was the best explanation, it's definitely true, the true one. I don't know whether that's the thing, but I think if we knew for sure something would be the best explanation, we kind of have to put into parentheses out of all the explanations we can think of right now to actually determine, like, so it would be the better explanation in the sense you were saying, and then we call it the best explanation of all we know. But I think it's still a very interesting question to think about. How do we actually determine what's the best explanation? So one thing I could think of is to go some type of Occam's razor. So we go for a very simple version. So if one explanation is very, very simple, like a rat bit into my cheese, and the other one is my flatmate made a Tom Cruise move and put all these kind of stuff into the kitchen to fly around the kitchen and then removed them so I couldn't see them, this would be a much more complex way, or you would posit a much more complex explanation to actually explain that there are a couple of holes in my cheese.
Yeah, that's interesting in a certain sense, because sometimes you can have like different values, like simplicity or coherence with other theories, or yeah, I don't know, explanatory power, that are supporting different hypotheses. And so the problem is like to weigh the different criteria and decide which one is more important. And sometimes you can even realize that the criteria that we thought of as important, they actually can be replaced by other types of criteria. And so there is some kind of value ladenness in science in a certain sense.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And then there's like, I was thinking of the idea that, I think it was like the Tulichevsky paper that we read for class, where she argues that you can find make a distinction between which values you want by looking at historical case examples where you kind of see trends of which ones tend to work out and which ones don't. So for instance, in physics, it turns out that being committed to causal determinism or ontological simplicity has worked out pretty well. And that might not be the case necessarily in other domains, but that's like one way of kind of trying to see which cognitive values in this case are, yeah.
So for example, I was thinking of an astronomical case when they postulated the existence of Neptune to explain anomaly in the orbit of Uranus. Mm-hmm. So that was a case where they postulated the existence of something that was not really fitting well with our Occam razor in the ontological sense, but it turned out to be good. So they found out that actually there was a planet that was really difficult to observe, but it was there. But the same kind of argument didn't work for explaining, for example, the anomaly of the Mercury's orbit. So they postulated another planet, but then they didn't find a planet there. And there was like the moment for Einstein and the general theory of relativity to explain the actual orbit of Mercury. Rob, did you want to say something?
Yeah, it's just about simplicity as a criterion. It seems like a really interesting one, because you know, on one level, you could think it's to do with aesthetics and things looking a bit nicer when they're simple. But is there anything sort of about the world or about science that means we actually would expect there to be simple explanations rather than complex ones?
That is a pretty good and contentious question in general. And there's this attempt to identify which values have what we call an epistemic function. And that is like the ones that kind of put on the right track for towards discovering truth, and which other ones are just like what we call cognitive, or just so happen to make it easier for us to like use one theory instead of another. And like, we usually wouldn't think that just looking at a cognitive one is kind of, that seems almost like wishful thinking, right? If you just, we have the one that is easiest to work with here, or like just happen to fit what I want in a theory, therefore it is true. So it's like on the onus for someone who's a realist, I want to use inference to the best explanation, and is committed to this idea that we have these values that guide our choice of best explanation to show that these are like truth tracking. I think there's something to like, the more sort of you tack on to a hypothesis, the more like ways it has to be false. So by minimizing the amount of stuff that you tack onto an hypothesis, the less chance it has of being wrong, like by pretty elementary probability theory.
That's a good point.
Yeah, this is really an interesting discussion. And I was thinking about some readings that I did last term on feminist philosophy of science. So there are people like Ellen Longino, for example, that are trying to show that there are a lot of criteria that we normally use in science that are not necessarily the good ones. And for example, feminist philosophers of science encourage some kind of heterogeneity instead of homogeneity in explanation. The idea of not finding only one unifying explanation for everything, but contextualize and take every situation case by case, so to avoid any kind of masculist biases. And so, for example, there are a lot of works in the human medicine and biology, particularly concerning the female individuals that were always considered as passive in science. And instead, this was just the result of a biased masculist perspective on what females and women are. And this is really interesting it's really important to understand what are the actual values that are backing our assumptions, that are backing our inferences. And so we have always to be careful, first of all, as philosophers, but in general as people, to understand what motivates our scientific research, what motivates our hypotheses and conclusions. So I think it was really an interesting discussion. I think we covered a lot. And I just wanted to thank all of you, in particular Gabriel. It was really exhaustive in his explanation. I don't know if it was like the best explanation of inference to the best explanation, but it was surely a really good one. I just wanted to remember to who is listening to us that you can find our website, philosophyexchange.org. where we have a blog with a lot of interesting discussions about philosophical topics. And you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter. And of course, we hope that you enjoy the talk and you will listen also to our future podcast. So thank you for listening to us. And thank you, all of you, Jakob, Robin, Gabriel, and see you next time.
Thanks. Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun.
Bye-bye, guys.
Bye-bye.